Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. It wasn't until 1993 that women were required to be included in clinical trials. Before then, drugs were mainly tested on men only. Despite a woman's biological and hormonal differences, the medical world has historically just researched men rather than including women. While there are researchers and scientists working towards changing this, recent talks by the Trump administration are perhaps slowing the momentum. What happens to health research when women is a banned word? That is the title of an article for The 19th News. The article covers the Trump administration's efforts in blocking DEI-related programs, including canceling federal funding for research programs for women's health. Joining us now is Barbara Rodriguez, interim health and caregiving reporter for The 19th, who was one of the reporters for this article. Welcome to All Sides, Barbara.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you for joining me. So, in your reporting, you talked about how researchers are receiving warnings not to use the word women in their research or in the titles of the research. Are researchers doing this to have a greater chance of still receiving a grant? Like, basically, is the word women really banned?
I think that's still being figured out. I, you know, just want to generally highlight from the article that my colleague and I outlined, you know, in our reporting, how these initial first weeks of the Trump administration is shaping the future of women's health research and health research that impacts queer people. We highlight the fact that the administration has taken a set of actions, including general funding cuts, executive orders around diversity, equity, and inclusion. These are sort of the dynamics that we're trying to explore and trying to capture this snapshot of what this means long term.
Right. And it's not necessarily saying that all research on women is banned, but you did find in your article that some research that is female focused is being threatened.
Yeah, I mean, there's this, like I noted just now about this diversity, equity, and inclusion language that the Trump administration is targeting intersects with conversations and research around gender. And there is this well-known understanding of a gender gap in women's health research that dates decades. And there's just big questions about how you can target diversity, equity, and inclusion and not target conversation research about gender and women.
I had a hard time equating DEI research and women's healthcare research because, you know, women are 50% of the population. And how can you ban research that focuses on half of the country? I mean, I asked that kind of rhetorically. You don't know the answer to that, right? But how can you ban research on half the country, right?
Yeah, I will note that part of our story, our coverage was about talking to researchers, scientists around the country who expressed feeling perplexed about this very same set of questions that you're raising. How can you do this? And our goal was to capture that confusion and that a bit of anger, a bit of just trying to figure out what comes next.
Yeah. And I guess when I think about it, you know, and the eliminating of DEI, I guess if the focus of the research was specifically on women of color or, you know, queer women or something like that, I could see that being banned. But then, like, the idea of all women, that's where the confusion comes in, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's just a big question about the ripple effect on overall medical research, and in doing that, it's difficult to sort of separate efforts to close the gender gap in women's health research and also research areas where sex differences and gender disparities exist.
Right. I wanted to talk about some of the examples that you highlighted in your article. Endometriosis, menopause, infectious disease contracted in pregnancy, and pregnancy-related death. Those are all conditions that would impact women only. Are these the types of research that you found the most concern about, regardless of if it's women of color or, you know, or how that comes down? I mean, these are conditions that men don't have.
Yeah, I think there was this concern about research being stalled on a wide range of health issues that you could argue maybe at first glance aren't gendered areas of health. But It includes areas that are asthma, heart disease, substance abuse disorders, depression. These are areas of health that have had different health implications for women and definitely have had an outsized impact on LGBTQ plus people and people of color who are already underrepresented in this space. And so it's just a range here where people are expressing concern about things that, like maternal health, and some of the other conditions. Fibroids was a key point in the piece as well. There's concern there, but then there's just this range of health, areas of health that are also going to have an impact on women.
Yeah, the uterine fibroids is a kind of a new area of study. It's something that, did it say in your article, up to 70% women can have an issue with? And it's and a lot is I can't remember the number, but anyway, a lot is unknown about it, and research is kind of just beginning in understanding how this condition impacts women and really impacts their health. And you had someone in your article who was just very worried about that funding being even slowed down.
Yes, I spoke with a researcher who had spent some time, gathering research, or excuse me, gathering finances to study the biomechanics of uterine fibroids. Just to be clear, uterine fibroids are tissue growths that can cause severe pain, bleeding, and even infertility in women. And it's incredibly maybe it's misunderstood, but there are so many questions about what causes uterine fibroids. And you might have noted that statistic that it's impacts up to 77% of women as they age throughout their lifespan. And so to not have as much information about a condition that is going to impact a lot of women throughout their life, to have anything that's going to impact a better understanding of that condition feels perplexing, at least according to the researchers again that we spoke with.
And I don't think you know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it because are there any calls for men-only research to not be able to be funded? You know, for example, funding for prostate cancer, erectile dysfunction, testicular cancer, because that would be one gender only.
There is a lot of that kind of response to the reporting of, well, what about, we're not seeing cuts to men's research or men's health research. But I got to go back to thinking about how overall impacts on health research will have a ripple effect on men. I kind of want to note that even since our reporting, there's been more specificity of certain areas of impact, and that includes research on cancer. And I don't know that there's, this specific types of cancer that would be cut, whether it's actually just overall cuts to cancer research. And so that's going to have an impact on men. It's going to have an impact on women. It's going to have an impact on people of all genders.
Now, you talk to researchers and scientists for your article. How are affected researchers and institutions responding? Are they saying that they're going to take steps to mitigate the impact? They're going to look for private funding? Or do you think, have any of them discussed suing the Trump administration for grants they were promised?
I think some of that's playing out. We made a decision at the time of our reporting to know that there was just so much back and forth going on. For example, in our piece, we highlighted the experience of a researcher at or a student at Columbia University. And at that time, when we were working on the piece in early March, there was big questions about the future of National Institutes of Health funding at Columbia University. We can go down a bit of a rabbit hole about the back and forth of that, but I think the bigger question is how are, like you noted, how are universities responding to this? I will say that other universities have been targeted over the future of their federal funding, and these universities have a history of funding medical research. I will note too that schools are, in some instances, rescinding admissions to graduate programs that included, in some cases, research that focused on gender disparities. I've spoken with researchers in different fields who say that they're exploring international work opportunities to continue their work. And so there's just big questions about what comes next, and then specifically, how are universities going to support researchers? How are they going to challenge threats of massive funding cuts that will impact medical research and other aspects of how they run their universities?
We're talking with Barbara Rodriguez, interim health and caregiving reporter for the 19th, one of the reporters for a recent article titled, What Happens to Health Research When Women is a Banned Word? And just for our listeners, you can find the article at 19thnews.org. Do I have that right, Barbara? 19th
That's
News.
right. Yes.
19thnews.org. It is a very extensive piece. I mean, Barbara, you and your co-writer did a great job. So I would encourage our listeners to read the whole thing because we won't be able to touch on it all. I have it printed out here. It's pages and pages. So congratulations on the article. But I'm sure that you have more questions now. Are you going to do a part two and part three?
Yes, I think when we set out to write this, we have just so many questions now about how do we capture the emerging data, the actual cuts that are coming through. I think as we hit different milestones throughout the year, the end of the general kind of university semesters, there were a couple of researchers who said, I'm in the middle of a multi-year research process here, and the funding has been cut. So the people I was, talking to for this research, big question about what comes next. And so I think it'll be really important as reporters to follow up, to see what it means to ask these questions at the start of the administration, and to also ask these questions 4 months from now, 6 months from now, 8 months from now, at the end of the year.
Now, I will say from all sides perspective, we tried to have a researcher join the show today. We sent out many requests to researchers in Ohio and outside of Ohio, universities and not. We got some no's and no thank yous. We heard back from a few who said they wanted to join but had scheduling conflicts. Through all of that, I got the feeling that maybe they did not want to draw attention, any extra attention to their research right now due to all the uncertainty. Did you run into that issue when you were reporting your story?
Absolutely. Some of them do not have long-term funding to conduct their research. It's just an actual reality of being a scientist or being in forms of medical research. They rely on grants, some of which has long come from the federal government. As one person put it to me, researchers spend years trying to secure funding for their projects. And so in this case, some folks really expressed concern about speaking out publicly, that the reasoning being, what if it impacts my current grants? I've had some canceled, but some haven't been canceled. I have long-term plans to explore this really underrepresented area. If I speak out now, what are the implications long-term? On the other hand, too, though, I want to make space for the fact that some research felt compelled to speak on the record. Some have tenure at their respective institutions, and they felt the need, they felt a level of confidence in being able to talk a little bit more and saying, I'm speaking on to I'm speaking for myself, but I also know that I have colleagues who don't feel comfortable speaking in this moment. So it's a really kind of a mixed bag, but it really does reflect the fact that people are worried about what it means to call out what they view as injustices in and a real hindrance to the future of medical research.
Yeah, I read about a few studies here and there who do have a significant amount of private funding. There are private funders out there. Specifically, there's some women private funders out there who have wanted to fund women's healthcare research. And, I get the feeling that there is private money. Is there plenty of it? I don't know. That's subjective. But the federal funding, is that more secure than private funding? Did you look into that at all?
I think I was trying to explore that, and my colleague as well, towards the end of our reporting, because I think there was a lot of A kind of doom and gloom of everything. What does everything mean here? And so I did try to explore a little bit of what does it mean to have other sources of funding kind of step up. I will note that there has been a lot of interest in women's health research and health research that, disproportionately impacts queer people. And I think they have more visibility than ever. We kind of note the fact that if you log on to social media, the algorithm is telling you about a wide range of issues, including menopause, that has some dollars attached to it. We noted just a fact of like economists sort of estimating that investing, $350 million in research that focuses on women could yield $14 billion in economic returns. And so I think there's just still a big question mark, like so many things that were highlighted in this piece, but I got a sense from some of the stakeholders in this area of health research that there could be a space for more private partnerships, more private investment. But another reminder again, though, that it will it actually fill the potential massive gap in funding if the federal government steps away to the scope that the reporting might start to indicate? That's a big question.
We are talking with Barbara Rodriguez, interim health and caregiving reporter for the 19th, and she's going to stay with us. All Sides continues in just a moment on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. The Trump administration is threatening to cut funding for any research that promotes diversity, equity, and inclusion. This includes flagging research with the word women. Many researchers are dedicating their careers to bridging the gender health gap. But what happens when the Trump administration pauses millions of dollars earmarked for this type of research? We are speaking with a reporter who is analyzing the impacts of funding cuts on women's health care, Barbara Rodriguez, interim health and caregiving reporter for the 19th, is one of the reporters in the recent article titled, What Happens to Health Research When Women is a Banned Word? Barbara, thanks again for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I mentioned at the very beginning of the show in my introduction that it wasn't until 1993 that women were required to be included in clinical trials. Before then, drugs were mainly tested on men only. 1993 was not that long ago, I feel like. So that kind of shocked me. So can you talk a little bit about what you found out in your reporting about how behind women's healthcare research is?
Sure. As we noted in our piece, it's really taken us decades to get here. It was only in the early 90s that the federal government even mandated that clinical trials include women and populations that they described at the time as individuals from disadvantaged backgrounds. I took some time to sort of look at the timeline between the early 90s and now, and there's just been these sort of incremental steps. The opening of a women-centered office in one agency and another and another, multiple kind of reports aimed at closing that gender gap. But it's really taken decades of stakeholders continuously year after year after year advocating for funding and space for women's health research. And so one of the things, though, that we wanted to also note, though, is that it had been a challenge. It continues to be a challenge. It was a challenge even before the Trump administration, came back this year, because we noted even just that there was this 2024 report, which was led by the group that's known as the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine. It was backed by Congress, and it found that in the past decade, the level of federal funding that is devoted to women's health had actually declined relative to the rest of the budget for the National Institutes of Health. And it in particular said that the report said that the quote, sex differences are not sufficiently studied or reported, and investments in women's specific research falls short. So that was 2024. And it's still also at the time, the Biden administration was making very big public commitments to collaborating between the federal agencies to improve women's health research. So it was a public priority of the previous administration. And even there, you still have the data showing that the federal government was not doing enough. So what will that all basically look like now? I want to highlight another thing that, the Biden administration announced this kind of so-called White House initiative on women's health research too. And so just some version of that continue now under the Trump administration? How do you announce? Oh, sorry, one other thing I want to note is that this report called for billions of dollars in additional funding. So how do you commit to billions of additional dollars at a time when there's news reports about, massive cuts to federal jobs and overall spending?
Yeah, you cite the Biden administration called on Congress to invest $12 billion in new funding for women's health research, but the Trump administration appears to have rescinded that initiative. And it's also kind of like the Biden administration did that in his last year, so maybe it was like a little late, like right? If he it hadn't really had time to get off the ground, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I think I don't know what the thinking was there for the Biden administration, but I know I've got the sense from our reporting that the former First Lady Jill Biden had also prioritized this. I was looking through just various video clips and announcements from the Biden administration. They had this big kind of summit conference at the White House, just weeks before President Trump returned into office, kind of noting this isn't a finish line, this is a starting point. We have built the momentum. And so, I'm not sure again about the timeline, but there was this, you get the sense that there was this real urgency maybe in that last year in office to make some serious movement here. So what comes now?
Right. And you also wrote in your article, and you mentioned it a few times, the impact that this will have on the LGBTQ plus community and on women of color. Those are both populations. I mean, if women of themselves are under-researched, then those are under-under-researched, for lack of a better word. I don't even know. So you yeah, you make the point that especially when it comes to pregnancy and issues with pregnancy, there's things that impact women of color more than white women, and we still don't know why.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that comes to mind when you're highlighting this point is just the fact that there are also researchers that we spoke with for this reporting that don't necessarily have federal funded research grants, but they rely on the work of data sets that the federal government maintains. And one of those is what's kind of known as the PRAMS, the Pregnancy Risk Assessment Monitoring System. It's this really well-known comprehensive database that has really detailed information about pregnancy-related health outcomes. And part of what makes that data set so powerful is the fact that it also, has data points about the disproportionate impact that Black and American Indian women might face, particularly as it relates to pregnancy-related deaths or people in rural areas facing greater barriers to reproductive health. And so I think it's just an example of also not just federally funded research grants, which was a bulk of the focus of this reporting, but also big, big long-term implications for, employees for the federal government, whose job it is to help connect researchers with what has long been publicly available data sets.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about this PRAMS data. Thank you for saying what PRAMS stands for. So basically, it's pregnancy-related data that is kept by the federal government. And you spoke with someone who's a public health professor in Minnesota, and they are basically worried about an interruption in the collection of the data because that'll make future research more difficult. It could end up with them comparing apples and oranges instead of apples to apples if there's any interruption in the data. And that has nothing to do with money. It more so is like they're also worried about, well, I guess it has something to do with money, but they're also worried about the people there who collect it not being there, right?
Yeah, there's been some reporting between even my colleague and I working on this piece, and since this piece is published, where there's just big questions about the future of PRAMS. We reached out to the federal government, the CDC in particular, that helps kind of maintain this data set, and they claim that it's kind of operational and its mission continues in terms of, identifying the issues that impact high-risk mothers and infants, and tracking health trends. At the same time, we are seeing reports of staff that job it is to help maintain that data set. And so it again, this just raises more questions about what does this all mean? We actually kind of had this whole back and forth where we were reaching out to the federal government about this, and then we also had the researcher kind of following up with us to say, here's an example of where I've got, staff that are trying to access this data as a new individual in this research space, and they're having difficulty. So does that mean new people coming into the mix of, data access are having more difficulty than an individual who might already have had access to it? It's just big questions at a time when that data is so crucial to continue to understand what it means to to address health disparities in pregnancy-related health outcomes and deaths.
Yeah, you cite an example where, because the Trump administration made these announcements mostly in March-ish, and you wrote your article at the end of March, and someone had asked for a data set from PRAMS in January and had not heard back, and they called that month of much of a delay not normal. So it was kind of like if they were asking for the information back in January before this was all in the news about funding cuts to university research and such, it kind of does make you pause and think about the future, right?
Yeah, I think again, this really hopefully provides information to readers, to our audiences, to folks listening right now about, well, what does this all mean? How am I equipped to ask more questions about what this all means? It's hard to sort of gauge how this impacts our lives today or tomorrow, but ultimately, months from now, years from now, if the full scope of the data isn't being collected, there's just big questions about what the data is going to look like in the future. How does that impact the scope of medical research down the road?
And I guess we'll just end with your article has gained significant publicity. And I just wanted to know your response to that publicity. And were you surprised by the reaction?
It's mostly anecdotal for now, reader responses and people kind of sharing it on social media, a bit of this general outrage of the long-term implications. I think in those first few weeks of the headlines that we're all reading about different cuts here and there, we started reporting just those general, cuts here and there, like I just said. And then this reporting aimed to sort of tie it all together a little bit more. The way somebody described it to me was that, they were one individual in, like, they were a piece to a bigger puzzle. And now that's how I'm processing the sort of emerging stories to these cuts, because, a cut to staffing here that impacts a data set, and the fact that an individual who's a researcher no longer has millions of dollars in research to look into LGBTQ plus issues that intersect with Alzheimer's research. These things are all connected, and they're going to have a disproportionate impact on women and queer people. It's sort of all connected, and soon it's going to really come into stark focus.
Barbara Rodriguez, interim health and caregiving reporter for the 19th, and one of the reporters for a recent article titled, What Happens to Health Research When Women is a Banned Word? Thank you so much for joining us today, Barbara.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to talk to the vice president of a new OhioHealth Women's Health Center that's opening here in Columbus. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. It wasn't until 1993 that women were required to be included in clinical trials. Before then, drugs were mainly tested on men only. Despite a woman's biological and hormonal differences, the medical world has historically focused on men only. But in recent years, gains have been made in research into women's health. And even though federal funding for women-based research may be cut or eliminated, the need for women's health care continues to grow. And that's where OhioHealth comes in. In 2023, OhioHealth announced plans for a women's center located on the Riverside Methodist Hospital campus. Construction is underway. It's expected to be complete in the spring of 2027. And joining us now is Christina Stucher, Vice President and Project Executive of the OhioHealth Women's Center. Welcome to All Sides, Christina.
Thank you.
So why did OhioHealth decide to focus its expansion efforts of all the types of medical things out there? Why a women's center?
Yeah, for us, we're really proud of the relationship we have with women in our community. At Riverside Methodist, already we deliver the most babies out of any hospital in Ohio. And we look across the system and we are pretty prominent in caring for women. And it was important to us that we start to invest in a deeper way and start to create a more differentiated experience for women. Really across the lifespan, not just in that maternity journey, but really to serve her needs, no matter where she is in her healthcare journey or lifespan.
Well, speaking of that maternity journey, Riverside did. I had both of my babies there,
oh,
so yeah.
Yay.
So I have a nice connection there as well. So tell me about the progress of the center so far, because I mentioned to you before we begin, I drive past it fairly often. You seem to be building quickly. I don't know if is it not quickly enough, or how's it going?
Yeah, it's going great, and we're building really. We're on track and on time. So. We are looking to open in spring of 2027. And so, I would say the hot, dry summer really enabled us to have some good success around concrete pouring. But we are really excited about the progress we're making. And yeah, that 315 hospital curve is really starting to look different.
Yeah. So it's going to be 8 stories tall.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure how many stories tall the current building is. Is that how tall is the current
building? Yeah. So we'll match the height of our Silver Tower, which is probably the last prominent build people saw on the Riverside campus. Mm-hmm. And so both the hospital side of the Women's Center will be 8 stories tall. And then we'll have a medical office building that is that height as well.
Okay. So you mentioned it goes beyond maternity care.
That's right.
So what else is going to be happening in the Women's Center?
Yeah, so we're really excited about what we're building, and the uniqueness of the Women's Center is that it's truly one destination to bring not only the inpatient care, but also the outpatient care. And when we talk about taking care of women across the lifespan, it really is around those ambulatory programs that support her healthcare journey. So you'll see inside of our medical office building programs, such as our fourth trimester clinic that we have launched out in our Dublin community, but we're bringing that also to the Women's Center that takes provides services to women in that postpartum stage, those really critical months, 3 months after a woman has had a baby. We're really excited about the investment we're making inside of midlife care. So supporting women that are perimenopausal and menopausal. And so we'll have a larger clinic inside of the Women's Center. It's launched in our New Albany Center, but now we'll have a larger. You'll see more expanded care for high-risk pregnancy, so our maternal fetal medicine program, surgical programs expanded. And we're also really excited about stepping into our first gendered primary care. So a primary care practice really focused on the needs for women and their families.
Okay. That's a lot to unpack there. Let's start with the perimenopause and menopause part of it, because up until, I mean, I'm not going to put a number on it, but let's just say up until like 10, 20 years ago, people never even liked to talk about the word menopause, let alone research it. But now that seems to be changing. Are we turning the tide here?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, women are really claiming their voice around wanting to have a larger dialogue around that stage in life. And we agree with them. And so we're excited to put together a comprehensive clinic that's really serving her in that stage. And so our first step into that has launched, and it's actually quite busy, and people are really excited to have that care. And we're having a lot of conversation with women in our community. I can't go anywhere when I'm talking about the Women's Center without women saying, what are we doing about that stage in our life? How do we have more discussion on it? What services are you going to bring? And so we're here to deliver upon that.
And also educating doctors, because there's doctors, no offense, but doctors of a certain age who just don't know how to treat women in menopause.
Yeah. Well, we're proud that in our Ohio health community that we have a lot of providers who agree with us that we want to do this better and differently, and who have been doing it. And now what we're doing is just bringing more attention to it and coordinating the care better.
So let's talk for a minute about how you're funding it. So talk about how are we paying for this giant 555,000 square feet building?
Yeah, it's about a $600 million project that Ohio Health is funding directly.
You said 600
million.
600 million.
Yes,
okay.
So it is right now the largest capital project we've had to date in Ohio Health. And I'm quite proud that that type of investment is going into women's health, which, you know, for us is a really big deal. And I think it's a really big deal for women in our community that we're getting that level of support. And we in Ohio Health are really proud that all, you know, as an organization, we reinvest our dollars back into our community. And so you're seeing that with the investment in the Women's Center and many other projects that are happening in Columbus, like even our grand expansion downtown. Reinvesting in our community is really meaningful for us.
Okay, so we spent the first half of the show talking about the idea of the Trump administration defunding research grants that focus on DEI, and that in some cases that's impacting research grants that involve the word women. So that just made me wonder, you know, you're actually building a women's center. The word women is right there on the sign. Do you have any federal funding wrapped up in the project?
No, we don't. No, this is truly an Ohio Health funded project. And so we, as I said, you know, we have a long history being servicing women in our community, and we're going to continue to do that. And we've heard from a woman, and they said that they want care that's better coordinated. They want it to be easier. They want it in a place where they can get a lot of things done at the same time. And so we want to deliver upon that and create a differentiated experience. You'll hear me talk a lot about, from a women's center, is that we want it to be a place where women come, and all of our associates that work at Ohio Health, that feel seen, heard, like they matter in the space, because we know that we can deliver upon that.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with the Vice President of Ohio Health's Women's Center, Christina Stucher. And, you know, it's no secret that many women lack access to health care, and research in women's health is also limited. That's what we were talking about in the last couple of segments. What sort of disparities in that lack of, let's start with lack of access before we address research. So in that lack of access area, what do you hope this center can address in that area of inviting women from every community in?
Yeah, we're really focused on that. We want to make it more of a frictionless process to get into care. Mm-hmm. And so, and we know that there's some friction sometimes accessing healthcare. And so by having a single destination for someone to come in and see a primary, and then if they need to have advanced specialty care, it's all in the building and how we connect and coordinated that. We also have other programs across Ohio Health that also enables for us to bring care to women directly. And so we're really proud of our mobile units that do provide women's care and primary care out in a lot of our other communities. And so you'll see us continue to advance those access to care programs by being not only a single point, but also coming directly to our patients.
Well, yeah, a choice had to be made whenever you were deciding where to build this tower. Mm-hmm. You could have put it anywhere in the city, mm-hmm. but you picked to mm-hmm. put it next to Riverside.
Yes.
Is there a reason?
Yeah, there is a reason. So one is we are actually moving our strong inpatient programs into the center. So as you said, you came to Riverside and had mm-hmm. your babies. And so we'll still be doing all of that maternity care. But what enables us to be next to Riverside is that we have direct access to highest level of care, and we don't have to duplicate those services by being away from, you know, our larger hospital. And so that also helps us with being able to access emergency care or higher level surgery or high end imaging without duplication, which actually, you know, ends up adding to cost of care. Mm.
Would I be able to do a one stop shop situation and see a primary care physician in the same building where I get a mammogram?
Yes. Yes. So we're going to have screening mammograms in the Women's Center. So we're really excited to bring that, as well as DEXA scans that do bone density. So all of those kind of imaging things that are really around the women's journey will be in the center.
You did mention mobile units.
Yeah.
So because there is that issue of people having trouble, you know, from more rural areas being able to get to downtown Columbus. I mean, you know, Riverside's not technically downtown, but you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. So I think, you know, while we're investing in the Women's Center right here, kind of in central Columbus, our entire strategy across our women's and reproductive health service line is investing in women's care across our 16 hospital network. So you're seeing us investing in women's care not only in Columbus, but all the places that we're at within Ohio Health. And it really truly is a network. And so we're really thoughtful around how do we connect those levels of care across our entire hospital system.
Now, in the other segment, we were talking about what happens to women's health care when the word women is being eliminated from some research funding, right? So as someone who's building a women's center, that has to concern you. What are your thoughts on it's changing daily in the news. No one really knows what's going on. But when you hear about research being defunded at Columbia and Harvard, what do you think of someone who's building a women's center?
Yeah, you know, I think about that. We live in a community that's growing, and I work for an organization that values the care that we do for our community, which includes women. And so we have really strong partnerships and relationships with a lot of groups in town and provider groups that are taking care of women and know what the needs that women have. Clinically and socially and emotionally. And so for us, we're going to keep doing the work. And so I think you see that through physical examples of the Women's Center. I think you're seeing that through inside of the city of Columbus and a lot of our partners who are responding to the needs of women's care in a unified way. And so we're really excited about where our investments are taking us, and women are paying attention, and we're listening to them, and we're trying to provide care that really answers the challenges that they have before them.
I know that for the most part, the Women's Center will be providing care, but do you have any aspects in your building where you're going to have people doing research?
So, you know, research typically is a lot of times coordinated with our care providers. So if one of our providers is interested in a research project, and we do have an Ohio Health Research Institute, they have an ability to do that. And so while we may not have a specific research area, but if it's woven into the care, and many of our, not only our providers, but our nursing teams often are doing research around how do we deliver, you know, best class care. So it's much more interwoven in our space than what you might see from maybe more traditional academic centers.
And in building this building, you said you you plan to have it ready by the spring mm-hmm. of 2027, right? Mm-hmm. So 2 years from right about yes. now. Yes. Have you faced any challenges in the building process? I mean, building a building is not easy.
Well, we have a great team. We're really proud of our construction team. So one thing I do want to highlight is that our construction team, our project team, we were really intentional about having women involved in every stage. So, So we have a great partner from our general contractor, and the lead of that local office is a woman. Our mechanical engineer lead is a woman. Our civil engineer lead was a woman, and our crane operator right now is a woman, which is really unusual. And then you see a lot of women around the architect table, around our user table. And so we're really excited about having a project team that is not only is designing a space for women by women. And so we've had a lot of fun with that. We've had really great construction ability right now. You know, we haven't had a whole lot of challenges, and some of them we're navigating on our campus that has come to bear for us around parking and things like that. But we have some solutions for that coming into the future. But I would say it's been going really well. I'm really proud of the excitement we have on site. A lot of people believe in the mission. And like you, a lot of people have such fond memories of being on campus and starting their families there. And so people are really excited and to be able to be a part of such a really strong construction project.
Yeah, I had a great care experience with your care team at Riverside. But even back then, my kids are older, but back then parking was an issue. So you brought up the P word. I didn't.
We're solving it.
Where are you going to put all these people?
Yeah. We're putting them. We have a lot of projects going on. And so the Women's Center has its own dedicated parking garage. And so mm-hmm. and then we're building some more parking for our associates and our patients over time. So we're really excited about that.
Okay. So where I see the tower being built mm-hmm. somewhere within that mess of construction
yes,
is a parking garage.
Yes, that parking structure is actually visible. That sits underneath our medical office building. And so we have a 5-floor parking garage as well. So women who come in for a visit or family members will park in our garage and have access to that one-stop shop.
Okay. I won't make you talk about parking anymore.
Thank you.
It's such a contentious issue. What do you envision for the center? Yeah. You know, it's going to open in 2 years, mm-hmm. but then like 10 years after that, what's the big picture?
Yeah. The big picture is for us to be able to deliver upon that differentiated experience and care. And where you're seeing our growth in the Women's Center is around how we take care of women across that journey. From an inpatient side, we are expanding a lot of our access to what I would say the higher level care. So there's growth in our high risk obstetric space. There's growth in our neonatal intensive care, because we know that that's an area that we're seeing a lot of growing with just how women are having babies a little bit later, delaying, or maybe having need more support there. I think the other thing is that more development of those outpatient programs. So care is going more outpatient. And so you'll see us continuing to evolve and saying, how do we continue to support women across the lifespan with, you know, women's heart health and all of the programs that we're developing, whether it's diabetes programs, all these things that we're building in, behavioral health, all of that really coming to life and growing more. And then we're also doing fun things to engage the community. So I would love to highlight, we're building in an education center and a conference center. And so where women typically come and they will engage with us in classes like baby basics or childbirth, but we're also partnering with our food and nutrition services team. Mm-hmm. We're going to have our first ever teaching kitchen there. So we want to support women around, if I got a gestational diabetes diagnosis and I want to think about what kind of meals might be better or might have some heart disease, we'll be able to support you and teach you the right meals. Or if you just want to say, I want to learn how to make my own baby food, we'll be able to do things like that. So, 10 years from now, we really want to be part of the fabric of the community, and people see it as a place for women and families to really engage in their health journey.
Wow. A teaching kitchen. That's very interesting. Okay. And then in the last 2 minutes we have, can you talk about more like the 10-year goal for older women, whenever we talk about like the menopause, perimenopause idea too?
Yeah, I love that question. That comes up a lot. So we have a lot of programs in the building for that. So think about as we're expanding some of our urogynecology programs, our minimally invasive GYN surgery program, and our primary care program, to support women not only in the menopause stage, but beyond that, and senior health. So we're talking a lot about what does that look like around senior health care for women inside of the center and bringing that wellness aspect. So more to come there, but that is another big area for us to develop.
Yeah. And, you know, we spent a lot of time in the first segment talking about different things that impact women and, you know, that don't impact men.
Yes.
So it's just important to remember that there are certain things that we have to pay attention to.
That's absolutely true. And so our goal is to provide services for all of those things.
Yes. Well, I want to say thank you for your time today. Christina Stucher, Vice President and Project Executive of Ohio Health's Women's Center. Thank you for joining us.
It's been a real pleasure.
And thank you for joining us today. This was All Sides with Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.